I've been an anxious person really my whole life, and I really never thought of myself that way, but when I thought back, even when I was really small, just a little boy, I was terribly afraid that my parents were going to die. And I can remember it, I mean, as soon as I was able to add and subtract, I would sit in bed and I would run the numbers, and I'd think, geez, you know, I'm 15, they'll be 55, oh my God, they'll never make it. And I would pray just so earnestly. I would ask God that they would be around for my life, you know, and the tears would just run down my cheeks. And I look back at that kid, and I feel for him. But so as I grew, this sort of anxiety thing kind of manifested itself in different ways. I was a naughty kid in school. I would do things like during a fire drill, I think in fifth grade, I jumped out the window for attention. And I was constantly staying after school and that kind of thing. And then in my teen years, my dad, who was a great guy, developed alcoholism. And, you know, one of the things that's pretty common to children of alcoholics is that you develop, if you didn't already have insecurities, you develop them. And so that definitely didn't help my situation. So as I grew into adulthood, these kinds of insecurities and so forth accompanied me, and I struggled in different ways. I did all right, but I lost jobs on a couple of different occasions, and 20 years in, my marriage failed. And anybody that's been through a divorce knows the alienating experience that you go through, losing friendships and so forth. And, you know, I did my share to, you know, sort of exasperate that. Still, as the millennium turned, I held it together in a fashion, and you know, I organized a new household on my own. I worked hard at being a good father, kind of a Mr. Mom of sorts, handling details and attending events and giving rides, and I learned how to cook. My kids gave my cooking a name. They called it Dick Doba. And that really was not a compliment. I got a dog, which was great, and then I took up running, which was one of the best things I have ever done for myself, because it really does, you know, help. It's a key part of managing anxiety and so forth. Anyway, I also dug in at church, and you know, I became a deacon, and I taught Sunday school, and I joined a household, and eventually I was elected an elder, and so, you know, I did good things, you know, and looking back, there's one story. The year this building opened was 1994, and I was elected deacon that year. And the first time I was the first time I served communion, I got here early, and I was all fired up and ready to go, and you know, you go in the chapel and you pray, and you get it, make sure everybody's there, and so on and so forth. And so anyway, I get up here with Jack and ready to serve communion, And we come up here, and he's kind of telling me what to do and so forth. And we grab the bread and the wine, and we walk down there, and we hand it, you know, and this is the body of Christ broken for you. This is the blood of Christ shed for you. When we walked around and did the same thing back there. And then we came to the front, and we were just kind of waiting. He was on this side, I was on this side, and waiting to get the elements from the middle of the circle. And a friend of mine was standing right over there, and he kind of motioned to me to come over by him. And so I went over there, and he kind of pulled my shirt up tight to him, and he said, "Reprimand the sippers." And, you know, he and I were kind of in simpatico about this. We had talked many times about how we just didn't like the sippers. And you have to understand that my perception is that sipping is not that big of a problem anymore at COS. I think that's part of a prior age. But in the 80s and 90s, I'll bet you 20% of the congregation were sippers. And, you know, we didn't like sippers. I mean, a lot of these people were good people. I mean, I loved some of these people. You know, like, I think back, and some of the finest people that have ever gone to this church, Wes Bonslar and Michael DeVries and Dan Grinwis and Ron Wells. Arnie Vroom, I think, was a sipper. Len Sweetman, I think he was a sipper. Ron Wells, in particular, I just got to say, I know my time is short, but I just got to tell you, Ron Wells, I love Ron Wells, okay? He was one of the three best teachers I ever had. And the first time I ever came to COS, he greeted me by name, and it had been 6 or 7 years since I had had him in a class. I couldn't believe it. Just a wonderful person. I love the guy. But that guy embraced a chalice of communion wine like a four-year-old grabs a sippy cup. I'm kidding. He really wasn't that bad, but he did. He was a sipper, I'll tell you. And, you know, I think most of the sippers now, are they either dead or they moved on or they've been reprimanded. Anyway, the problem with that story is that when he said that to me, that's not what I heard. I didn't hear reprimand the sippers. What I heard was examine your zipper. And so that was the whole point. The point of telling you this story is I'm an anxious guy, okay? And I'm doing communion for the first time. And I don't know if he's kidding or if he's serious, but I had just washed my hands, you know, so that I could handle multiple loaves of bread. And we had 5 circles to go, and I was not going to check if my zipper was up. And so I did some calculations in my head, and I thought, he's got to be kidding. There's no way that's, you know. So anyway, I could go on about that, but I'll move on. I grew up, got into middle-aged as a fairly successful person, but somebody with anxieties and so forth. But when I got to about the year 2010, in that range from 2010 to 2015, I found that my reserves were kind of drying up. The Great Recession hit me hard, as it did, I'm sure, just about all of us. And about that time, I was elected elder. And that experience was fraught with conflict, and I rushed into the situation where angels dare not tread, and I was ill-equipped, really, to emotionally handle the whole situation. And I handled it very poorly, After a year, I ended up resigning from that. All this stuff didn't just happen at once. So while that's happening, over about a five-year period, things in my own family, people close to me, were in serious trouble. And I can't really go into what that's about, but it wore on me, and I became depressed. I stopped exercising, and I started smoking cigarettes again, and I gained weight, and I withdrew socially and stopped going to church, and I was pretty angry at the world. And it came to a head, the whole thing kind of came to a head in 2015. It was at my son's graduation, the day after my son's graduation from medical school. And 2 weeks earlier, he had gotten married. And it was out east. And so it's the day after the graduation, and I had this expectation that we were going to spend a little bit of time together. And he and his new wife explained to me that they were exhausted and they were going to need a little bit of time alone. And so it wasn't going to be possible to be together. Well, I lost it. I just got furious, and I just lit into him like a Christmas tree. And I left their house, and I just sat at the airport for 8 hours waiting for my flight. I ignored their phone calls, trying to get things back together, and it was just something I'm terribly ashamed of. And in truth, it had nothing to do with them. It had nothing to do with it. But the fact of the matter is I was kind of at the end of my rope at that point, and my life had become unmanageable, and basically I felt like I had lost sanity. Sorry, it's going to take more than 8 minutes. Two people who love me made a suggestion to me that I attend Al-Anon, and that turned out to be just fabulous advice. I wish I had done that. My mom and I had talked about it when I was a teenager, but we were sort of self-righteous, I think. I think we thought we were too good for it, but what a mistake that was, because it's just turned out to be a wonderful thing for me. It was the first place where I felt like people understood my own brand of insanity. These people knew what it was all about to fly into a rage out of the middle of nowhere, and they had suffered failing to cure what they hadn't caused, just the same as me. So they encouraged me to relinquish this control that I felt like I had to have over my life. And as Alcoholics Anonymous puts it, they encouraged me to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, which I thought I had always done, but I really doubled down on that. Don't worry about me. I cry at reruns of the Waltons, so if I get a little weepy here, just bear with me. So I did that, and I started to focus on myself and my role in the problems that were occurring around me. And I got out of the vein of self-pity, and I determined that I was going to have a little courage to change and to live with a little bit more acceptance of my circumstances and a little more gratitude. These folks gave me the benefit of their common experience, strength, and hope. So I began to progress in all sorts of ways. Silly, simple things like They have all these sayings in Al-Anon. It's kind of corny, but it really does help. Things that most people figured out a long time ago, but not me. Things like, say what you mean what you say, but don't say it mean. Or, I can't hurt others without hurting myself. So Al-Anon helped and continued to help me keep on track. It still is keeping me on track. It's an ongoing kind of thing. It's a little bit like going to church. You never stop going. And then came two more people in my life. And that would be Mark Fackler and Jack Rhoda. And not that they hadn't been in my life before, but I hadn't been going to church for quite some time. And I got a card from Mark Fackler. He was the new chair of the elders, and he just wanted to see if I would have coffee with him. So I said, sure, I'll have coffee with you. So we had coffee, and he said that, and I'll warn you, I have yet to tell this story without starting to cry, so oh, we'll see. Anyway, we had coffee, and he said, you know, Jack, I kind of am his shepherding elder for now, and I asked him the question, you know, is there anything that's bothering you, or is there anything that's on your heart, or whatever, and I'm sure he had a list of a few things, but one of them was, I just feel bad that Dick DeYoung is not going to church anymore. I told you. So we met, and I don't know if I can tell the story, so we'll just say that we met, and it meant a lot to me. So I began a process of intentionally fixing some old flaws. So here's what they looked like. I started working at forgiveness first of all, starting with myself, forgiving myself. I'm just going to skip over a little bit because I know I'm going on too long here. And then, you know, I've been working on relationships too, trying to get people that I need to forgive, going through that process, and eventually, you know, there will be people that I need to seek forgiveness from. The second thing that I've been trying to work on is this idea of turning my will over to the will of God. And there's a wonderful prayer in the 11th step of AA that I have used as a daily prayer. And that is, grant me the knowledge of your will and the power to carry it out. It just seems so straightforward and kind of gets to the point. And so that has become sort of a mantra for me. And then there's the concept, the third concept of abiding, which comes from John 15, I and you and me. And, you know, I haven't been the most fruitful tree for the last number of years, but one thing I did do right is I continue to pray. And in response to those prayers, you know, as I mentioned, it came two family members calling me to Al-Anon and two church members calling me back to worship. And so, you know, when I abide in him, it's been my experience, he abides in me. So years ago, I taught a Sunday school class, and the text was Matthew 28, the Great Commission. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore,
Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age." I taught that lesson that day, just as prescribed, you know, it's about the Great Commission. But for me, what I saw, the thing that I just honed right in on was that last sentence, "Remember, I'm with you." And it just struck me that the last, very last words on his way out the door, you know, were a concern for our welfare. You know, it reminded me of years ago, like 35 years ago, my sister went on vacation, and Heidi and I took care of her kids, her little kids, and the conversation kind of went like this, as the suitcase is already in the car, and I think my brother-in-law was already behind the wheel, and she's going over these instructions with the two of us, and she said something like this. She said, "Okay, feed Sheba at night. Tom will fall back to sleep unless you get him all the way out of bed. Feel free to try, but I'm telling you, Eric will only eat chicken nuggets. When Susan says baya, it can mean 30 different things, but 80% of the time she wants a juice box. If Tom sleepwalks, don't wake him up, just guide him back to bed. Here's the emergency numbers, including Alger Pediatrics. Here's some cash for a little fun. Don't let them play catch with the hamster." And then she said, "But forget all that and just please keep them alive." And you know, the last words are the ones that count the most. And so I pictured this Great Commission passage as sort of a truncated version of the conversation they really had. And it went with the disciples something like this: "Feed my sheep, pray for your enemies, do unto others, turn the cheek, remove the board, take my yoke, suffer the children, keep the Sabbath, taste and see, 70 times 7, love your neighbor, make disciples, teach them to obey, but most of all, more than anything I've said, remember, I will be with you." Excuse me. This just struck me as so profound, and it got me thinking about other profound words that have been said at the end of life. And I remember being told that the old professor from Calvin College from a generation or two before me, Professor Harry Jellema, is supposed to have said on his deathbed, "All is grace." And my childhood pastor, Jake Eppinga, his final words are reported to have been, "I see angels, lots of them." And my own dad, the last thing he ever said to me was, "It's been a joy to be your father." So Jesus' last words to us, according to Matthew 28, "Remember this, I will be with you. You will not walk this world alone. I am with you always. I'll never leave you, ever. Always with you forever." So, for me, the resurrection means hope and rest for an anxious soul. Hope to which I try to respond gratefully by believing the gospel, by forgiving, by desiring God's will, and by abiding in the Holy Spirit, who is with us always.